Hello and welcome to RCGP Podcasts. My name is Dr. Thomas Round. I'm the Essential Knowledge Updates Clinical Lead for the RCGP. And today I'm speaking to Dr. Kevin Barrett, who's a GP with an interest in gastroenterology. And we'll be having a chat today about FIT use in primary care, and that's fecal immunochemical testing that a lot of us will be aware of now. So hi, Kevin.
Hi, Thomas. Thank you for inviting me.
And Kevin, we've had a chat before, I think, with previous podcasts.
We have, thank you. Yes, I like gastroenterology, particularly lower GI work, partly because I'm a patient myself, I have inflammatory bowel disease, but partly because actually it's one of the most interesting areas. It's one of those bits that often gets neglected. I've been a clinical champion for the RCGP and Crohn's and Colitis UK for their inflammatory bowel disease spotlight project that ran from 2019 through to 2020. I've also been the chair of the Primary Care Society for Gastroenterology, which is a fantastic organisation that seeks to promote primary care gastroenterology, you know, anything from the upper GI through the liver down to the lower GI as well. I've been the chair of that organisation and I'm still an active committee member. So I'm not a GP with a specialist interest in gastroenterology, but I'm a GP who's very interested in gastroenterology, if that's the best way of describing myself.
Thank you, Kevin. And you are a practicing GP near London, I think, is that right?
In Hertfordshire, so just outside London, in a fairly suburban type practice. So I see a wide range of patients from all sorts of backgrounds.
Today, focusing on FIT, F-I-T, fecal immunochemical testing in primary care. So a lot of us will be aware of this a little bit pre-pandemic, but I think it's really come into focus during and after the pandemic with guidelines changing. And we'll be having a little bit of discussion today about the British Society of Gastroenterology, maybe a touch on NICE guidelines. But yeah, I mean, just to start off, how do we define this test?
That's the test that looks for blood in faeces. It's a development from the previous faecal occult blood testing that was around for a long, long time that gave you a yes or no test. So it was a very, very black or white type answer that we got from that one. And lots of false positives in that test, particularly with foodstuffs and other things that we were all aware about. So it wasn't a very popular test and it wasn't necessarily a very useful test. But this test actually gives us a much more accurate analysis of the amount of human blood that's in the stool and actually gives us a quantitative number that we can use to look at various thresholds for screening versus symptomatic patients and onward referral. So it's a much more useful test in a wide range of situations.
So a lot of GPs will be used to now getting these numbers through. So that's kind of a quantitative calculation of the amount of a breakdown product of human blood, right?
Yes, that's right. It's a very straightforward test. We give the patient a kit. They do the test usually at home and send it off and we get that number back. And then that can be used for finding which patients are at higher risk or lower risk and where we go from there too. So it's an interesting test. And I think one that we are definitely using a lot more of it. And I think it's important that we are aware of some of the limitations of the test, but also the fact that actually where it can be incredibly useful. So it's a test that when it first came up, I looked at NICE guidance and I looked at the test and thought, well, so very few patients in that group that would fit the criteria of having this done in the original NICE ND12 criteria that I thought, well, actually, I don't really see a place for this. However, particularly since the COVID pandemic happened and the delays in endoscopies and huge increase in waiting times, I have actually come around to love it. I think now that you understand what it's for, where it can be used, I am doing a lot more of this than I ever was. So I actually think it's a really fantastic test.
And I think pre-pandemic, there's some evidence for low risk, but not no risk patients. So patients maybe not quite meeting the urgent suspected cancer. We used to call previous 2-week wait criteria from NICE. So we might use it a little bit in practice. But as you say, since the pandemic, there's been quite a lot of primary care based research and systematic review and good quality evidence that it is an effective test, even in high risk populations. For example, those patients meeting that NICE criteria for referral.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's the particular group that we tend to use it in the most. The National Screening Programme is a slightly separate area with different cutoff points as well. I think we know from the NICE guidance that when ND12 first came out, they set the threshold for referrals at around about the 3% likelihood of having a positive cancer diagnosis. And that's the criteria they use to set the different thresholds and different groupings for referral. There's evidence that they've now come out to say that actually, if you have a patient who meets NICE ND12 criteria, so all those complicated bits about being over 40, 50, 60 with the various symptoms in there, but they have a negative or a FIT that's less than 10, their risk of actually having colorectal cancer is 0.5%, so much, much lower than that 3%. Not zero, but certainly a lot lower. So that can give us quite a lot of reassurance in that group that we can identify those patients who definitely need to be investigated and those that should be investigated and those that probably don't need to be investigated. I think those are the three main groups we can help secondary care divide patients into.
you mentioned a little bit about screening. So FIT is used for screening. We're not going to go into that in detail, but just to be clear, it is a different threshold, isn't it, for the screening population who don't have symptoms?
So yes, a much higher threshold. So for asymptomatic patients, they typically develop a FIT of around about 100 to be picked up by that screening program. It does slightly vary, but that's the typical threshold that's used for that screening program. So again, if you see a patient that develops symptoms and they've had a recent screening, then actually we still do another FIT on that patient because of that threshold. So a negative screening FIT doesn't mean that they'll have a negative FIT for symptomatic patients. So we should absolutely still do a repeat FIT test in that group.
I think that absolutely, isn't it? It's about that messaging. Even if you've got a negative screening test, you get symptoms, you still need to assess that and reassess it and potentially redo the test. As you say, it's a different threshold. Going into the testing then, so I call it to my patients a little green topped dipstick that you put in your poop. And there's quite good patient materials, isn't there? It's really about encouraging patients to do this and reducing barriers, because we know in certain groups similar to screening, maybe patients English not first language or different minority groups more at risk, maybe learning difficulties or other particular groups might find that more difficult to do these tests.
Yeah, absolutely. The test itself is one of the easiest tests to do in terms of obtaining a stool sample. You don't need to actually poo into a particular very small pot like we do for other tests, like we had to do for fecal calprotectin, for example. This one, it's very straightforward. You can put a bit of paper down the toilet, you can put a container into the toilet, and then you actually just use the cotton wool tip of the testing kit to get the sample from. So it's much easier to do in practice. I think there are still barriers to that, and some people are still squeamish about it. I like to actually get the kit out and show it to my patients as I'm labelling it up. So I've actually printed off the labels, handed to the patient myself, for those patients we see face-to-face, and explain to them how to actually do the test there and then. The thing about pooing is that almost everybody poos. So I explain that to people, that parents will poo, they poo, I poo, the king poos. I think back in Tudor time, the king used to have one of his servants would be there to actually help him go to the toilet and analyse his stool as well. So the current king doesn't do that. That stopped in sort of Victorian times. But I just explain to people how to do it. So it is difficult. As you said, there are certain groups who find it harder than others, but there are lots of resources we can use to help that. So patients with learning disability, for example, are a particular group. However, they've often got access to the learning disability nurses, to carers, to friends and family that can help them with that as well. So there are usually ways around that. But even with that, there are still some people who just refuse to do it or physically can't do it for whatever reason. And I think it's important that even though the referral criteria in our local policies will mandate that we do a FIT test, there should still always be a way that we can refer those patients who can't do a FIT test. They can still get access to those investigations if they need it. And it's just making sure that we do have that process in place, that we do use that where it's appropriate to do so.
I think it's a really good tip. In our practice, we've got a little envelope that we put the FIT tests in with simple instructions for patients to do it. As you say, get out the kit and show them patients yourself if you're seeing them face to face. Or if we're doing digital consultations, we've got some videos and other links we can send to patients via text message to try and encourage. We'll probably come on to safety netting a little bit later on. But I guess we touched a little bit about the NICE criteria. As I understand, it's useful even if patients do have rectal bleeding. Some people query about, oh, okay, if there's fresh blood, would it just pick that up anyway? But I think, as I understand from the technology, it differentiates to broken down blood product rather than fresh blood.
Yes, it can do. I was cynical about that when I first read it, but actually speaking to the gastroenterologists and the lab people that analyse the test, they say actually that is true. The key with this though is if you have a patient with unexplained rectal bleeding and you've seen them and you've examined them, they don't have a rectal mass or abdominal mass, all those things that we should be doing with our patients as often as we can do, that if they have fresh rectal bleeding, that when they do the stool sample, that they actually dip the tip of the testing kit into some stool where there isn't any obvious blood, so they avoid any obvious blood when they dip it in. That's much more likely to give a true result. The evidence is in patients with rectal bleeding, actually this test can be used, it's still valid, it's still appropriate, and the same cutoff and criteria still apply for patients even with bright red rectal bleeding. So yeah, in that group we should absolutely still use them, and it's still appropriate and still useful.
I think also in the BSG guideline, it talks about, obviously, we should still examine if patients have anal mass or ulceration with symptoms, we still refer those patients irrespective of FIT testing.
Yes, absolutely. And that's what NICE. Again, with remote consulting, it can be difficult sometimes, but wherever we can do it, it's best to actually see the patient in front of us, see whether they look anemic, feel their abdomen, examine their rectum with a chaperone, obviously, and refer if they do have that rectal mass in there as well. Unexplained rectal bleeding is difficult. It's a term that causes confusion sometimes, and it's very easy to say that a patient with previous hemorrhoids, for example, if they come in with rectal bleeding that's similar to what they've had before, that we can easily put it down to hemorrhoids. But I think a patient who has symptoms that are slightly different their normal symptoms or worse than normal symptoms, it absolutely can be worth doing a fit test in those groups, even if they had a previous fit test a year or two beforehand. If things have not settled down again, it's definitely worth thinking about repeating that test again.
So we've seen that patient, they maybe fit nice criteria. We arrange that fit test, hope majority of patients do send it back. We might have some embedded safety netting systems, text messaging, or you can put little prompts to patients or within your own practice to make sure tests are returned. And obviously we get then the test result back, and then how do we then interpret that?
There are two or three main versions of this test available. They all tend to give the same sort of results. So either a result that's called negative, which is a funny term for this, but it usually means a result that's either less than 4 or less than 10, or we get a result that's higher than that. So we actually get the number back. Negative test in this context is an interesting term. I think that means either undetectable or result less than 10. In that group, that they're an interesting group because, like I said, the likelihood of them of actually having significant bowel pathology, so colorectal cancer, premalignant polyps, or even inflammatory bowel disease, is very low, but it's not zero. So again, we need to use our clinical acumen to an extent, and also the patient's history, and think about the constellation of symptoms that they might have as well. So if they have one symptom and a negative fit, the chance of having colorectal cancer is very low. But if they have more than one symptom, so for example, they have abdominal pain and weight loss and a change in bowel habits, those three symptoms are low, the alarm bells ringing. And even if they have a negative fit, you would still think, well, actually, I need to keep an eye on that patient. I need to do some very secure safety netting, and maybe even think about reviewing them in a couple of months' time and actually maybe repeating the fit test. Again, it varies from patient to patient, and it can be very, very difficult to do that, but we have to be very clear to our patients that if things change, if they persist, even with a negative fit test, that they need to come back. The advantage of having the fit test is it does allow the secondary care units to risk stratify patients into different groups. And a typical risk stratification group you'd have is a patient who has a fit test less than 10, doesn't need investigating unless there's a particular reason to do so. A patient with a result between 10 and 100 needs to have some kind of investigation done, maybe a routine sigmoidoscopy, something along those sorts of lines. But a patient whose result is greater than 100, then they almost certainly need to investigate on a fast track, 2-week wait type pathway to see what's going on. So you can easily group them. And that does save resources. It means that the patients that need the colonoscopies and sigmoidoscopies done do get seen in a timely manner. And it saves resources. So one of the bits of guidance, of a bit of evidence that NICE use, if you had to do a colonoscopy on a patient who has a negative fit test, you actually need to do over 600 colonoscopies to pick up one patient with colorectal cancer. So it's a lot of resource that is being used that could be targeted patients
and not without some risk. So we know there is a little bit of risk of perforation and time off work and other things required with colonoscopy as the gold standard test.
Indeed, absolutely. I've had a few in my life, and they're not something I look forward to having either. So absolutely, as well as the risks and the discomfort, not without those risks and potential harms. Yeah.
I think it's quite simple-ish. If it's above 10, we do our standard urgent referral to the hospital for secondary care for assessment. But as you say, it's that tricky group where it's maybe less than 10 and they've got symptoms. So as you rightly say, you could reassure it it's unlikely to be cancer. But you quite rightly say around that reassessment, safety netting, etc. I guess then also thinking about using the fit test to pick up other pathology. So I think we talk about cancer, but of course, other serious pathology could give a bit of blood, couldn't they? Inflammatory bowel disease or other serious bowel pathology.
There's lots of table evidence around this, and high-risk adenomas, inflammatory bowel disease are definitely two things we can certainly pick up with this. We will potentially get false positive results, so patients with rectal bleeding caused by lower GI infections, that they can obviously make you bleed and cause problems as well. But you usually pick that up from the history and the length of the symptoms that the patient has got. But yes, it's a really useful test. The other test we do use quite a lot is fecal calprotectin, and there's a lot written about that and published, and I think almost everybody now in the UK at least has access to fecal calprotectin. There may still be one or two pockets around who don't have easy access to it, but calprotectin is a different thing. It's a calcium binding protein released in the presence of inflammation, and that looks at a slightly different subset. So there is an overlap. It's like the typical Venn diagram where we have some patients with colorectal cancer who have a positive calprotectin and some patients with inflammatory bowel disease who have a negative calprotectin but a positive fit test, for example. So there is an overlap between those different groups, and they do certainly suit slightly different populations. So we can think about which test to use in which situation. But if we have an older patient in that 40, 50, 60 year old plus age group that's set out in NG12, then fit is probably the preferred test in that group. And then calprotectin is probably better used in the younger age group. Although you can use the same test in different age groups depending on the symptoms and their previous history as well. So it's not quite as clear cut as that. And it's not something we should automatically reach and do both tests in every patient, because we're going to end up tying ourselves in knots and using lots of resource and causing inappropriate investigation.
as you rightly say, it's the more the older population, but we do know there is increasing rates of bowel cancer in young populations. So maybe in that younger population, think about, is it appropriate to do both tests? Definitely more in that sort of older population where you're thinking about, does this patient need a colonoscopy to use that FIT test?
Yeah, definitely. You know that we do sadly see younger patients with colorectal cancer picked up on a reasonably regular basis. And I think the ones who are at higher risk of that, so the ones with that very strong family history, or the ones who had a long history of inflammatory bowel disease from a young age, they're certainly at higher risk of colorectal cancers. We can use FIT those groups, as well as the older ones who come to us with more straightforward symptoms.
And just touching a little bit, Kevin, on the BSG guideline, they did a systematic review of primary care studies on there, and it looked at the sensitivity and specificity of the test. So obviously people will be aware of that, and that tells us how likely it is that someone has the disease or not compared to the gold standard. So as I understand, the sensitivity of the test is upwards towards 90%. So then you might say then it's a pretty good rule out test, but it could miss one in 10 cancers. And then how does that relate to then to the high negative predictive value of the test, which is above 99%?
It's much more useful as a rule out test in that situation. And I think figures, they do vary according to the result that you get as well. So if you look at the figures, they split the figures into less than 2, greater than 10, greater than 150, or various different thresholds as well. Those figures do change as you increase the result of that FIT test. The issue with predictive values is that they also vary according to the prevalence in the population.
Yes.
And that does make a big difference. In primary care, the number of patients that we see with lower GI symptoms are huge, and yet the number of patients who actually have significant pathology is quite small. So it is looking for that needle in the haystack, and I think that explains some of those figures. If you look at different populations, so those who've already been screened or those that have turned up in the secondary care clinic, then the likelihood of picking up significant pathologies is usually much higher. But the general rule of thumb is a negative FIT test is usually means there isn't any significant pathology there. And I use the word usually with emphasize that word. But the higher the result is, the more the likelihood there is. So it's a screening test, not a diagnostic test, in the same way that calprotectin is, for example.
You rightly explained that. So it's a sensitivity. It might miss one in 10 cancers for just purely for the test, but the prevalence is pretty low in the primary care population. Even those with potentially nice criteria might be 5 to 10%. No, NICE talks about that 3%. So if you look at the prevalence and the sensitivity, then it gives that negative predictive value of over 99%. So you can reasonably certain that patient doesn't have serious bowel pathology or cancer. But as you rightly say, if they've got a spectrum of ongoing symptoms, things not settling, reassess and maybe do another FIT test. I think there's some evidence that that could increase the sensitivity.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, there's some smalls that looked at serial FIT testing and did increase the likelihood of picking things up as well. Again, I'm not aware of any clear guidance about when one should repeat that test. If there is another cause for bleeding, lower GI infection, for example, and you want to give that a chance to settle down again. So typically, my personal practice would be probably to think about probably not doing it any sooner than the month, or probably nearer sort of 2 or 3 months down the line. And then you compare the values and have a look at them as well and see if there's any change. There are some patients who will keep coming back and back and time again for repeat investigations. And we've seen that with the screening tests that we do. So it's providing enough reassurance to the patients who are very unlikely to have colorectal cancer or inflammatory bowel disease, that actually that they don't need repeating those tests, whereas keeping that sixth sense going for those patients who we think actually they're older, they're at higher risk, they've had other diseases, they're at much higher risk, and actually looking at that group and maybe doing the test, maybe repeating the test sooner than we might otherwise in other groups. So there's a slight art to it as well as an absolute with this. Might be to see with lots of general practice.
As you say, as a lot of symptoms, particularly with GI, could be functional IBS with related, if they have got bleeding, then piles or hemorrhoids or other non-worrying pathologies. And it's kind of picking out which patients do we think have got potential pathology and will need that gold standard diagnostic testing.
Oh, indeed. And it is picking a needle in the haystack. So we know that patients with one lower GI pathology can develop others. And it's just being open to if things are different to their normal pattern of symptoms, that actually we need to go back and not quite start from scratch, but go back and reassess them again and think, do I need to reinvestigate that patient? It is difficult. There's a huge overlap between all sorts of lower GI and gynecological conditions as well. So you just have to be open-minded to that and think actually that sometimes things like that do happen to patients who've already got a diagnosis.
It's important to really think about your local pathways as well. So everyone will have to be a little bit different. Of course, if you're FIT positive, use the standard referral in. I think a lot of areas are thinking about symptomatic FIT negative pathways, which maybe are not urgent, but you could get advice and guidance, or maybe think about risk assessment for those patients.
Those pathways are fantastic. I know there are some areas that some members of the primary care side of gastroenterology are involved with, where we have GPs involved in those clinics as well. So the suspected cancer referral pathways tend to have a very clear pathway. You're seen, you're assessed, they've ruled out cancer, and then you're discharged again. But the patient often has ongoing symptoms, and they come back to primary care saying, well, I don't have cancer, but I'm still not right. So actually having those pathways and involving GPs in those pathways can be fantastic, because we're often actually really good at providing that slightly more holistic assessment than perhaps secondary care can do. Secondary care are actually fantastic at this, but sometimes involving GPs in that pathway gives a little bit of added value to it. So yeah, if you've got one of those pathways, I'm very envious. I think they're fantastic, and I think you should have more of them.
As you say, there's a lot of overlap with symptoms, isn't there, with upper GI and lower GI. So particularly if you've got patients with vague symptoms, bit of weight loss, over 50, a lot of areas now have rapid diagnostic centres as well, where there's a lot of overlap with abdominal type symptoms, maybe fit negative, but you're not quite sure what's going on, you're a bit worried, you might potentially access that RDC, which in a way is accessing for CT scanning if you're worried about symptoms.
Yeah, indeed. One of the arts about gastroenterology primary is also about deciding how much to investigate and where to draw the line. So actually, I've ruled out enough significant pathology. I can give you a firm diagnosis of a functional bowel disorder, for example, and being confident enough with the patient that you can say, actually, this is what you've got. This is how we treat it. This is where we go. However, if these things change or something different happens, then absolutely please come back. It is difficult. And I think it's becoming harder to do these days with perhaps that loss of continuity of care that we used to have more easily, and the different ways of consulting. So it is hard, but I think it's not impossible to do if we know our patients, use our consulting skills that we've all been trained to do.
That's great. Thanks, Kevin. And any top tips to summarize into practice?
My top tips would be to do the holistic assessment of the patient, to take a very thorough history, and to try and examine the patient wherever we possibly can do, because that gives us extra information. If we're doing a fit test, again, look at the numbers of that fit test and the local policies and pathways. If we get a negative fit test, so a fit test is less than 10 or 4, depending on what the local lab says, we can be pretty confident there's nothing serious going on. However, we absolutely must safety net that patient, so that if anything does change or does persist, they need to come back to see us again.
Thank you very much, Kevin. And if people want to read a bit more, as I say, we've got an essential knowledge update module covering the British Society of Gastroenterology guidelines on FIT. We've got also a recent British Journal of General Practice article on this area. And yeah, look at the guidelines. And as I say, it's an evolving area and the evidence base pretty robust in primary care, but it is evolving. And I think maybe we'll be looking at sequential FITs, et cetera, in the future and the combination with other tests. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you very much.
You are listening to the RCGP Essential Knowledge Updates podcasts. Thank you very much for listening.